This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Bob Garfield with an OTM Podcast Extra. In about 60 seconds. Look, the production of On the Media has never been cheap or easy. Now the process is crazy and expensiver, too. Now more than ever. As they say, we need listeners' financial support. Obviously, many of you are absolutely strapped at the moment, and we surely expect you to sit this one out, but that only increases the need for everyone else to step up. Please support OTM when we and you need it most. Go to onthemedia.org and hit donate, or text OTM to 70101. Thank you. Gosh, can this really be from only a month ago?
What do you have to lose? Take it. I really think they should take it. But it's their choice, and it's the doctor's choice or the doctor's in the hospital. But hydroxychloroquine, try it.
There's more than ample evidence that hydroxychloroquine saves lives, speeds up recovery time, and cuts down on hospitalizations. It's also one of the safer drugs out there just by virtue of the fact that it's been around for, 65 years?
Yes, amid a panic to find a treatment for COVID-19, certain politicians and certain corners of the media fell in love with a drug proven a few weeks later to present mortal risks outweighing any potential efficacy. This is what happens when hope triumphs over caution. The hydroxychloroquine debacle should have been a lesson learned, but now comes the bandwagon for the antiviral drug remdesivir.
Gilead, the biopharmaceutical company behind the experimental drug, today reveals significant positive results in trials of the drug.
Yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci was very positive about a study of an experimental drug to treat coronavirus called remdesivir.
The New York Times reports that the FDA is planning to announce approval for emergency use of this drug.
So you get to choose. You want good data or you want fast data? And we've been getting fast data mostly up until now, with all the problems that come with it.
Derek Lowe is an organic chemist who's In the Pipeline blog for Science Magazine explores drug discovery and the pharma industry. The headlong rush toward remdesivir began with the publicizing of a trial conducted at the University of Chicago.
Publicized is the right word. It got a lot of publicity because what happened was this was a study being run by Gilead, the makers of remdesivir. It was open label. So it wasn't the conventional sort of blinded trial where no one knows who's getting what. This one was open label being done in, I believe, moderate to severe coronavirus patients. And there was a video chat going on between some of the physicians at the University of Chicago's health system, and one of them talked about what they'd been seeing with the drug. As far as she could tell, someone, and we don't know who, was recording this video chat and later leaked the whole thing to the press.
And there's some suspicion that it may be somebody connected with Gilead or someone who holds a large position in the company's stock, because this news sent the Gilead shares soaring in value.
It's a moral hazard because clinical trial results are the real currency of biopharma finance. Do you have a drug that works in people or do you not? So gigantic moves in stock prices occur on the basis of these things. So you have to discourage people extremely strongly from doing this kind of leaking. Now, in this case, the data had already been collected. As far as I know, they had finished up the trial, and this person was talking about what they'd seen so far.
So it didn't contaminate the results of the experiment such that it was.
Not really, but you can contaminate the results very easily by leaking along the way. And in that case, contamination is the real word. You can mess up the trial to the point that the FDA will say, we're not taking any of these data.
It found its way to the world through Stat News.
Right, and Stat's a very reliable publication. If they hadn't reported it, someone else would have. Journalists report news, and this is news. It would have been different if this had been an ongoing trial and reporting it would have blown the entire thing. I'm not sure what they would have done in that circumstance. A lot of the people who work at Stat have been doing this for a long time and they know exactly what those stakes are.
In any event, with the publication by Stat News, the spread of the story began and the potential cure narrative with it. How hyperventilated was the reporting?
Some of it was bad. And honestly, no matter what the tone of the reporting, a lot of the people seeing the headlines were going to run off with the wrong idea anyway. Someone was telling me that they were sitting at home when this news started to hit, and one of their family members ran in shouting, "They found a cure! They found a cure!" That just makes me sad.
At the same time as the press and the public perhaps was overreacting to this very preliminary research result, scientists were also paying attention. And it's my sense that virologists and pharmacologists and immunologists were not themselves getting all hepped up.
No one who really was knowledgeable about the field expected anything gigantic from this. The hope was that there would be something. The drug did shorten the amount of time that people were in the hospital, and it had a trend to possibly helping with mortality. That didn't reach statistical significance, but it might be real. And that's all we know. We know nothing else yet.
All right, that's the Chicago study. There have been other data points that have trickled in. Can you tell me about them?
Unfortunately, the one controlled trial we have is the one that we don't have all the data for. That's the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, NIH trial. Gilead has published some more retrospective, uncontrolled data, and it's almost impossible to know what to make of that kind of data. That's what I was referring to earlier when I talked about fast data and good data. The quickest thing you can collect is to say, okay, we're already giving people this drug, because remember, remdesivir has already been tried on other coronavirus. It's been tried on Ebola, any kind of RNA virus. But you say, we're already giving people this drug. Let's just collect the numbers on what happens to the people that we're giving it to. But that's not controlled. You don't have any standard of comparison. So at the end of that, you can say, okay, we gave it to whatever, 53 people, and here's what happened to them. You don't know what would happen to 53 people, similar disease severity, similar balance of genders and age and pre-existing conditions, who got everything except remdesivir. And without that, you really can't tell.
Hydroxychloroquine was a fiasco of overhyping from the president and Fox News and others before the evidence started mounting up that it's, for many patients, quite dangerous and not necessarily effective in fighting COVID-19. The hype over remdesivir doesn't reach that scale of distortion, does it?
It doesn't. Remdesivir seems to be a lot cleaner as far as adverse events go, so it's a little easier to make the call to give it to people.
Well, one of the reasons that a cure is so elusive, and perhaps a vaccine as well, is that COVID-19 has properties that are baffling. All the king's horses of science and all the king's men of pharma have failed to have much success in curing viral illness of any sort.
I've done antiviral research myself, and it is like breaking rocks for a living. They are very tough. Viruses have very few moving parts in them as compared to a living cell, so you don't have too many shots on goal. And that's why when you look at hepatitis C or at HIV, where we can at least stop it, if not completely eliminate it, both of those are cocktail therapies. There are several different drugs given simultaneously, each of which attacks the virus in a different way. There are no single drugs that knock out a viral infection, and there's precious few combinations. So Hep C really is a success story. The Gilead combination for that cures hepatitis C. Now, a lot of companies put a lot of effort into that over the years. There were a lot of competitors all working on it. There are other companies on the market until Gilead finally blew them out of the water. But it took years of work, and I could not begin to tell you how many billions of dollars and how many man hours to get that far. That's the sort of targeted small molecule therapy that people are used to in a drug, and that's what it will take a long time to get for the coronavirus, which is why, personally, I'm putting my faith more in the monoclonal antibodies and vaccine work.
Dr. Fauci has not dismissed the notion that a vaccine could emerge within the next 12 to 18 months. Does that seem overly optimistic to you?
It's optimistic, but it's not impossible. The only thing that is on our side with this is that there are so many large organizations working on this simultaneously, each with their own angle. The failure rate for new drugs is about 90% across clinical trials. No other industry deals with that. I mean, 90% of Boeing's planes get off the ground. 90% of Pizza Hut's pizzas are perfectly edible, but 90% of clinical candidates fail. 94% of vaccine candidates fail. But if we have dozens of companies working, each with their own take on this, the odds of one of them getting through, I think, are pretty good. And we already had done a lot of work on SARS and MERS, which gives us a leg up. There are coronavirus vaccines for animal diseases, so we know that in theory it's possible. I think we'll get there.
As we've often reported on this show, the media are generally terrible, terrible about maintaining skepticism and perspective about potential miracle cures. But in this drug development warp speed moment in which we reside, I suppose the media are especially prone to oversimplification, excessive hope, and worse. What are you seeing out there?
As you say, they've been hyping early results forever. I've been writing the blog for 18 years now, and that's been a constant throughout the whole thing. So I long ago gave up any hope of that ceasing to happen. I'm just writing a blog about this. I do drug research as a day job, and even I can't keep up with everything that's going on. It just does seem like too much some days. So I really am not too down on journalists under these conditions. You know, I'm willing to cut people a break.
Do you have any advice for journalists who are coming up against these tensions for the first time?
There's a narrative bias in journalism, and indeed, I think in the human spirit, that we want stories. We want things that have a beginning, a middle, an end, a hero, a villain, a big wrap-up where all the loose ends are put together. The coronavirus doesn't care. The cells and dividing in the dish don't care. The mice in cages don't care. The world doesn't care how great an inspiration this was or how beautifully it all fits together. You'll look at an explanation that someone has for virus therapy, and it just hangs together so beautifully. Honestly, the more beautifully it hangs together, the less likely I think it is to be true. It's messy. A lot of really, really compelling storylines are wrong. So I would advise people to get ready for that.
Got one more question for you. I'm asking you to give me a moral judgment, please. You're speaking to somebody who is on 8 different pharmaceuticals and I have been for decades, and they have prolonged my life in a way measured in years and perhaps someday in decades. I am alive because of big pharma. So, you know, that's a big thumbs up there. On the other hand, I've spent decades observing the industry and seen its corruption, like the apotheosis of capitalist malice. And I wonder which is right.
Why not some of both? We are people, and I say we as in the pharma industry, and like every other organization run by people, there are grievous faults. Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. But the idea is that we can harness the self-interest, the desire of companies to make money, to do good for the rest of people by putting the insane amounts of money and effort that it needs to find these new drugs. Believe me, there are things that happen in the drug industry, you know, the Martin Shkreli's of the world, that make everyone in the industry want to spit on the floor. So it's an odd place to be. You know, there's fallible humans trying to do things that could change the world. And sometimes the world-changing part wins out, and sometimes the fallible human part wins out.
Derek, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Derek Lowe is an organic chemist. His blog, distributed by Science Magazine, is called In the Pipeline. This has been an OTM Podcast Extra. Come back this weekend for the big show and a deep dive into the stagnant waters of the newspaper business. Meantime, for all the thrills and spills you've come to expect from the OTM brand, subscribe to our weird-ass weekly newsletter at onthemedia.org/newsletter.